A view of the distant past today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Novelist Jill Bartelt will explain her fascination with ancient Troy, after which Garrison Keillor will chime in with the Writer's Almanac on Scribble. Ancient Troy. My goodness. Jill, whatever prompted you to take up Troy as a subject?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for having me on this show. I'm so honored to be here. I came to the legends of ancient Troy through perhaps a strange avenue. French literature was my major.
Now, and... wait a minute. Let's see. I've tried the French literature. How does that compute?
I don't know.
You'll have to explain that, Jill.
Well, one of the most famous French playwrights is Jean Racine. He was a 17th century playwright. And the favorite play of mine that he wrote was called Andromaque. And the main character in this play is Andromache, just with a different pronunciation. And she's one of the, I suppose, minor figures in the Iliad and other versions of the Trojan War, but in... Andromaque, it's set after the war, and she's a war widow. It's set after the Trojan women, in fact, that we just saw put on by the Genesius Guild. It was a wonderful show. And so she's already been taken captive to...
I think Racine took that from a Greek play, didn't he? There's a play, Andromache, that we've done, but my mind is kind of fuzzy. Do you get into much historical novels?
I don't. I do like them, but I don't know. I read a lot of mysteries, and I don't like historical mysteries.
Oh, okay. Well, there's no mystery about Andromache. It's just bad all the way.
But, you know, my first question, Jill, was, you know, what time of the day do you write? But I took a look at the size of the three books you brought in, and my idea is, when do you rest? I
can't lift them.
No.
They're good weightlifting.
How did they get so long?
Well, I've been writing them for 8 years, so that played into it. I do get up early to work on them. 4 o'clock in the morning is kind of my time to start. But I wanted to write about when I read the works about Andromache. I thought about her life before the war, and there's not really much about that in the legends. So I just got to thinking and thinking and thinking, what might her life have been like, and that's where this came from. And I guess I thought about it in a lot of detail.
Did you write an outline?
I didn't.
Well, I mean, that I don't use outlines either. So you don't write.
I
do mean. You sort of create a character and kind of let that character do what the character wants to do? Or
yes, very much. I let the character, and frankly, I started out with the characters having a little bit different tone to them, and it just didn't work out, so I let them change as they wanted to change. It's more character-driven than plot-driven, and so I thought of scenes, they came to my mind, and then I wove the rest around those.
So is this historical fiction in the sense that it's very carefully done, and how much research did you have to do?
I did do a lot of research. I researched the types of writing and the languages that were around in ancient Anatolia, and I researched the plants and animals that are native to the region. Troy is found in modern-day Turkey, and my husband and I actually got to go there and see the archaeological site, which was very exciting. And so I looked at the topography and did that, but also since it's based in legend, I felt free to some extent to play around with. I didn't want to include anything that was historically impossible or, you know, disobeyed the laws of physics or anything right. like that. It's not a fantasy, but at the same time, I did play around with things that were maybe not likely, but could have been possible.
But three books, they're not all about Andromache, are they?
I'm sorry. This top one is a copy. There's
oh, okay.
just two. I made some marks in it.
Two, okay. But oh, that's a relief.
So there's just two. They are all about Andromache. Initially, I thought that this was one book, and then about 4 years ago, I came to my senses and read what word counts were typically in books, and I thought, well, no, that's not one book. Actually, it's at least two, and I couldn't bear to split it up more than that, so because it still feels like one work to me.
Wow. But you worked on that 8 years, huh?
I did, yes.
That is a labor of love, and you clearly fell in love with this character.
I did, very much so.
And that means, I guess, you've treated her well. Could you give us an excerpt from the first novel, is it?
It is.
Okay.
And this comes toward the very beginning of the novel. And should I set it up or just go ahead and read?
Well, set it up a little.
Yeah,
okay.
Set it up.
All right, so my Andromache before the war was having a little bit of a different history than the one in legend. The one in the legend is a princess, and the one in my story ends up as a refugee, and she lives in one village, but she actually comes from a different land altogether, a different part of Anatolia. And the village that she's in now, this second home to her, is about to be raided. So this is more or less where the story starts.
Mm-hmm.
The sea was dazzling under the midday sun. The very waves seemed to catch fire. For two straight weeks, the heat had been ferocious, leaving some of the villagers to mutter about sorcery. Even the young woman, who was weary of their superstitions, had to admit a certain strangeness to the world. In the shimmering air, nothing looked like what it really was. The young woman sat down and dipped her bare feet into the creek. The water was surprisingly cold. In the space of a moment or two, she could no longer feel her toes. She didn't move them, didn't make even the slightest effort to bring feeling back to them. Numb, her feet matched her insides. She hadn't felt anything for days. What was there left to feel? Auntie was gone. Auntie, who had taken care of her since the death of her parents. Auntie, who had brought her here to Lernassa all those years ago. Auntie, the last member of her family, the last person on earth who loved her. The death hadn't come as a surprise. Auntie had been old and sick. She'd worked herself into the ground, making a life for them in Lernassa. Still, the inevitability of the loss had made it no easier to bear, especially since all of Auntie's efforts would now come to nothing. Alone, the young woman wouldn't be welcome there. The villagers thought she was cursed. Someone had left her a few tidbits of food, but other than that small gesture, no one had come near her since Auntie's death. No one had mourned with her. No one had helped her with the burial. Alone, she'd hauled the dead weight of Auntie's body to the sea. Alone, she'd floundered over to the place where the currents pulled out hard. No one had been there with her as Auntie slipped out beneath the waves and disappeared. The young woman was jolted from her thoughts. Down by the shore, one of the village boys was hollering what sounded like, "A ship! A ship!" The young woman frowned. A ship? Despite the blistering heat, a chill ran through her. Could it be true? Was there a ship? At first, none of the other villagers could see it. Their vision wasn't sharp enough to pierce the gleaming air. Then they looked again, and that time they saw something. A seabird, someone said. A ripple, said another. By the time that no one could deny it was a ship, the thing was almost upon them.
I really like the way your style seems to fit the time and the subject. There are parts of that, of what you just read, that are almost chant-like. Is that something you fell into, or is that the way you always have been writing, or?
Well, thank you for saying that. I suppose I fell into it. I really learned to appreciate poetry when I took classes in grad school and fell in love with hearing the sonorities of words and the rhythms of the sentences. And I would never call myself a poet. I'm not that
but there are
that
lines
level of
there
creative,
are,
but I would love to.
I mean, that did read
influenced.
Like a prose poem.
Well, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah,
very
there's
much.
The cadence to it.
Yeah.
Very strong and very, very attractive. Boy, and then you go through two solid books with Andromache.
Yes.
The Loss of a Child and then the Another Family in Captivity. And
well, this is all set before the war. So this is all parts of her life that I imagined and that were not explored in the traditional versions of the legend. So
now, Jill, what are you going to do now that you've got Andromache bound? Are you through writing? Are you going to write some more? What's the situation?
This story, I believe, has closed its door. And in these two novels, what I set out to tell was told. So I don't see a volume 3 of her life in that sense. I would love to continue to keep writing. And I write all the time. I mean, my husband and I just went on a trip, so I write about that, and I, you know, do some travel writing sometimes. But
I guess what I'm looking for is you've written about Andromache and soaked yourself in that period. Do you think your next novel will come from that period as well, or do you want a clean break?
I honestly don't know. This idea, now the writing process involved so much hard work, but the actual idea was sort of just came to me. It was sort of an inspiration to me. So I'd want to feel that again before I devoted another 8 years to something. And I haven't yet. So we'll see. It's a mystery.
The next one might take only 2 years, Jill. I mean, you've been through the mill. How much re-editing did you have to do?
Constant. In the last year I was working on it, I think I read it through about 14 times and took a pen to it every single time and just constantly kept at it. And I would always throughout the day be thinking, well, that word might work best, or that phrase needs to come out, or things like that. So constant.
That's kind of the way you write, isn't it, Tweet?
What?
Constant re-editing.
Well, I do it exactly the way Jill does it. I can't do it formally, but I go through. I was telling somebody this morning, I spend about 8 hours writing an essay about the Des Moines River, and which comes out of Lake Chetek, I think, in Minnesota, about whether it dribbled out or whether it eased out or whether did it dribble or ease. And, you know, and in the morning, dribble seemed to be winning. By the afternoon, ease seemed to be. It is. I mean, words mm-hmm. do have a way of controlling how you think, and it is important to you, if not to the reader.
Was it words or was it whole sections that you had to change?
Both. It was absolutely both. I was sometimes, well, to bring it back to French, I was sometimes looking for that mot juste, the right word, the one that's just fitting, you know, dribble or ease. But then also there were times when I knew a section wasn't working, and I would spend a whole day looking at a paragraph and, you know, just trying to make it work. And in the end, it would just have to come out. Or
yeah, that's why I don't write fiction.
to make sure, before we run out of time, where can somebody get a copy of this?
It's available on Amazon. It's available on Barnes & Noble, mostly online at this point. I'm working at having it in local independent bookstores as well. So it's an ongoing process.
And how did it get published?
I published it.
Okay.
I published it. I had some very specific ideas of how I wanted it to be, and I wanted to have the creative control. So I looked into various options, and I decided that's what I wanted to do.
Well, which is pretty much how things generally work today, I think. And then, you know, eventually maybe something mm-hmm. else, but
well, you know, I know I've talked before about Gail Brown as a Fraser. She has 20 novels still in print, and yet she made a pittance because she had a publisher, and the royalties just did not keep up with the sales. And if you want to have anything coming back from it, self-publishing seems to be the way, unless you are guaranteed an early run of 50 or 100,000 copies.
Right.
Yeah, it's that's a brutal part of writing.
So have you done readings at places like Barnes & Noble?
I haven't yet. I'm still in the early stages of trying to get myself out there. It's not something that comes naturally to me. So my husband is the artist who actually did the covers, Mark Nelson.
Oh, wow. Oh,
and
very good.
He's been very helpful. He goes on Twitter, and so he'll sometimes tweet about my books and help me get word out that way. And other than that, it's just going into shops. And I've done a few signings. I've at my public library in Kewaunee, they were lovely and had me do a talk, a book talk there. So I've done a few events like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, you know, it's your baby that you've got to care for and nurture.
Yes.
And that's the thing about writing. Unless you are writing for yourself and want to put it away in a closet, once it's written, once it's printed, that's when the work begins.
Yes.
And you've got a lot of work to do, huh?
I do.
The other question I really want to ask you, since you're going so far in the past with this, is do you think human nature has changed, or is it just the cultures and customs and the little surface underneath is the sea as calm as it ever was?
I'm so glad you asked that, because I think that's the eternal appeal of this legend, is that it has everything in it from human nature. It has love and friendship and jealousy and war and peace, and it has all of those things, and family drama. And I think those themes are so common to every culture.
And have been, right?
And have been all along. And every culture made it their own. I mean, Euripides was using the legend to speak to conflicts in his time. And Racine was using it, and, you know, the people that are the characters that are in it, like Andromache, she comes across as a noble from the French court. You know, there's as much as she does someone from ancient times. So, I mean, there's always these links that can be drawn from this material to every culture, I think.
So how about redoing this in modern times? Just take Andromache and put her in Kewaunee. You know, I mean, that's been done. James Smiley in 1,000 Acres redid King Lear.
Yeah, that's right.
There's a modern feel. I read you a passage that was third person, but when they are having dialogue, then I feel that it sounds much more modern. I mean, it's not like the sword and sandal movies where the actors speak with a British accent and they're very proper. My characters sound more like I would, I guess, is the best way of saying it. So I think she would be at home in Kewaunee, I suppose. But I wanted to make a little more of a creative space for myself as an author and get to explore that.
What do you mean by creative space?
I wanted to be able to think up what another time would look like and the items that they might have or the types of cloth they might use, or, you know, look into what kinds of plants were even around in that period of time. Just, I was also a history major, so I like looking into those things too.
Well, I must say, Andromache and Kewaunee sounds very appealing. But thank you so much, Jill, for being with us today. Jill Bartelt, who has written a large novel that's really in two parts about Andromache, a fascinating character from Greek literature and legend. Here's a fascinating guy, a fascination all his own. Support for Writer's Almanac on WVIK comes from the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products and services to hospitals throughout the region. Information at bloodcenter.org. Does Jill Bartelt's story inspire you to start writing now?
No, I saw the size of, I mean, you cannot believe the size of those books. Unbelievable.
Yeah, but solid writing.
Solid writing. The book I have to recommend is based on something she said, and that, you know, and I've been thinking about that a lot lately too, is that underneath all the cultural differences and incredible habits that different people in different cultures have, deep down, people don't seem to have changed very much. And that reminded me of a book that Nan Carter just sent me by a Egyptian writer. The name of the book is Brooklyn Heights, and the name of the writer is Miral, M-I-R-A-L, and then A-L-T-A-H-A-W-Y, Tahawi. It is about a young Egyptian woman from a Bedouin community in Egypt, and it's contemporary, who moves to Brooklyn Heights, which is where an awful lot of refugee groups, particularly from the Mideast, end up. She has along with her a young son who's 7 years old or so, and a book of manuscripts, which she intends to turn into a book if she has time some days. And she moves into a small apartment, is terribly lonely, the book vacillates between her experiences on the streets of Brooklyn Heights and the Bedouin community from which she came, in which it turns out, although the customs are completely different, the loneliness is just the same, right? It seems to me, I was just talking to somebody else the other day about how we have all sort of become the lonely crowd. Groups don't meet very much in groups anymore. There was a book 10 years ago, was it called Bowling Alone, that talked about the coming of loneliness. And this is an incredibly lonely book. This woman doesn't speak English very well. Her son speaks English much better than she does. And she goes down, she knows where, there's a little Syrian enclave she shops at. But her life is exceedingly lonely, and it's the same kind of loneliness that you see, I think, in many places in our culture today. Her habits are Bedouin. The community she lives, Brooklyn Heights, is an immigrant community, but it's not terribly different from Rock Island, or Minneapolis, Minnesota.
You know, I think we are so hung up on obvious differences in skin color, in clothing, in culture, and so on, cultures that have to do with a particular nationality or even religion or something. And we don't look past that at the essential humanity of every other living person.
You know, it's like the surface of the sea, which is boiling on the surface or calm and varies. You know, no 2 days are alike, no 2 waves are alike. But 50 feet down, there might be a slow difference, but it's all the same.
Yeah, and to find that human quality, that's the thing I think that makes novels.
Well, that's what
work.
Jill said. Yeah, if you can hit that kind of quality deep down, then your character is enduring, whether it's Elizabeth and Jane Austen or her character Andromache.
Yeah, it's
or the girl in Brooklyn Heights.
Yeah, I must say, it's the human condition, and as long as we're human, we'll keep writing. Name of the book again and the author?
Brooklyn Heights by Miral al-Tahawi. And it's a very short book, but it is a powerful book.
Okay, very good. Well, with that, we will close the page on this edition of Scribble. We'll be back next week, and we hope you will, too. I'm Don Root with Roll Tweet. Thank you for joining us on Scribble.